Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Hello, my name is Jeff Steinberg. Today is Tuesday, the 23rd of April, 2002. Welcome to the LaRouche Connection. As many of you undoubtedly already know, Lyndon LaRouche is widely recognized around the world as the leading political economist of the planet today. He is well known for his proposals for the bankruptcy reorganization of the current hopelessly bankrupt international financial system and its replacement with a new system based on the most sound principles from the Bretton Woods arrangements that existed between 1944 and the mid-1960s. LaRouche is also perhaps even more renowned for his proposals, first for a European productive triangle, and later for a more elaborate concept known as the Eurasian land bridge, which would create a series of large-scale development corridor and transportation projects linking the entire Eurasian landmass and then building bridges across the straits into Africa, a tunnel and bridge arrangement across the Bering Straits, linking Eurasia, finally, after many centuries of planning, with the nations of the entire Western Hemisphere, and other similar kinds of projects. Now, one may fairly ask, if one takes a frank assessment of the present poor state of affairs among leading governments throughout the world, first and foremost the Bush administration here in the United States, what kind of realistic hope could Mr. LaRouche and his collaborators have of seeing these proven successful ideas actually put into practice, when in fact the present world situation is careening out of control? Events in the Middle East are certainly driving the world towards not only a regional war, but the dangerous outbreak of a new religious war, a kind of global 30 years war of the sort that Samuel Huntington and Bernard Lewis and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Kissinger have openly advocated in their proposal for both the clash of civilizations, or in Kissinger's language, the end of the Westphalia system, referring to the Treaty of Westphalia that created the conditions for restabilization of Europe after the 30 Years' War had caused decimation on the European continent from 1618 to 1648. So with a Bush administration looking more and more like an imitation of Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman, with no sense of leadership, particularly residing in the president himself, with Europe a mess, no really particularly viable governments in Europe, the events of last Sunday's French elections, with Jean-Marie Le Pen coming in a close second behind President Chirac, and the two will now be facing a runoff in several weeks, you see a disaster in virtually every country in Europe. You've got a situation in Japan where the Japanese government is in a state of severe denial over the fact that the Japanese economy has been in a recession or depression, in fact, for the last 3 to 4 years. So with this kind of paucity of leadership, what is LaRouche actually doing? What is his game plan for victory on behalf of these policies that he has been so eloquently advocating for so many years? A bit later in the show, we're going to see a conference that LaRouche addressed in Milan, Italy, on March 22nd of this year, a conference sponsored by a major Italian organization that took place at the majestic setting of the Judicial Palace in Milan. And I think that in a certain sense, you'll get an answer to the question I've just posed as you see LaRouche organizing around these ideas with leading Italian political figures. Now, the fact of the matter, to give a short answer first, is that for the past years, for the past half dozen years in particular, since LaRouche was released from prison after having spent 5 years in jail as the result of a George Bush, Henry Kissinger manufactured railroad frame-up prosecution and conviction, LaRouche has been working tirelessly to force a discussion among leading political institutions worldwide around the idea of what policies will suddenly become the only practical solution to a global breakdown crisis, a systemic crisis, at the point that that crisis itself hits with a series of resounding shocks. Does LaRouche or do any of us know exactly when that crisis is going to hit? Obviously, the answer is no. We don't know the precise date. We don't know precisely what the trigger will be, whether it will be a military confrontation in the Middle East causing an oil shock, whether it will be the final collapse explosion of the Japanese banking system, whether it will be some sort of major financial or monetary cataclysm right here in the United States. Those kinds of details don't lend themselves to crystal ball forecasting in advance. What is certain, however, as certain as the fact is that the sun will rise every morning, is the fact that this crisis is near upon us, and that some combination of shocks will occur that will put the issues on the table of leading heads of state around the globe to take immediate action. Under those kinds of radically altered circumstances, ideas and policies that right now seem the farthest thing from the minds of policymakers will suddenly become the only pathway to survival. So Lyndon LaRouche is traveling around the globe and presenting in the most clear-cut fashion the kinds of ideas that will be the only solutions available at the point that the crash occurs. LaRouche is encouraging leading policymakers today, right now, to engage in a rigorous dialogue about the kinds of policy solutions that must be urgently adopted at the point that the crash takes place. Whether it's a week from now, or 6 months from now, or 2 days from now, the policy solutions remain the same. LaRouche's proposal for a bankruptcy reorganization and restructuring of the international financial and monetary system to adopt the gold-backed fixed exchange rate system that was first adopted in 1944 at the Bretton Woods Conference and which served the world economy, particularly the countries that participated in the Bretton Woods system, very well for the next 25 or so years until leading financial institutions moved to destroy that system and replace it with the floating exchange rate system of globalized looting, globalization, free trade, and the takedown and destruction of much of the world's productive sector. So LaRouche has been presenting these ideas so that at that moment of crisis, when the crash occurs, policymakers will not be caught blind, but will be in a position to say, now we move to implement LaRouche's policies thoroughly, rigorously, without compromise. And under those circumstances, LaRouche himself must be brought in as the key policy-shaping advisor so that these policies are implemented with the maximum degree of success. Now, in the last 3-4 months, Lyndon LaRouche has brought this message to leading policymaking circles around the globe. Last December, he spent several weeks in India, which was then followed by a trip to Russia. Prior to that, in late November, early December of 2001, he was in Rome, Italy, for a series of meetings there. And last month, he was in Milan, Italy. And now, in the immediate days ahead, LaRouche will be doing a new international webcast to discuss these ideas before an audience in Washington, D.C. So now let's look at that historic Milan conference of March 22, 2002. And I apologize that the camera crew that was responsible for videotaping this event did not exactly do a masterful job. And therefore, we apologize in advance for faults in the filmmaking. But I think you'll agree with me that the profound importance of the ideas makes it a worthwhile topic for this edition of the LaRouche Connection, regardless of those problems.
Io passerei quindi la parola subito al nostro gradito ospite. L'intenderemmo organizzare questo incontro con la relazione professor LaRouche, lasciando poi al dottor Raimondi il compito di moderare quello che sarà un dibattito successivo alla relazione del professor LaRouche. Grazie.
There are three things I take up with you today. One, the nature of the crisis, its inevitability. Secondly, the problem that this represents for Europe in particular, and the general remedy for the problem. And thirdly, the specific function of the non-corporate, essentially, producer, an entrepreneur, in this process of recovery and restabilizing society. First of all, on the question of the economy, one should understand that the world monetary and financial system in its present form is doomed, and nothing can save it in its present form. This is a result of the changes in policy which were introduced from the United States and Britain during the period approximately 1966 on. There was a change, as many of you know who are older, there was a change from an orientation toward a society based on production values to one which was called a consumer or consumption society. The change was in the former period. We used to think of solving problems in terms of production, in terms of better quality products, producing more. The way to solve the problem of unemployment was employment. The general way to solve unemployment was productive employment. We used often productive employment and infrastructure as a way of stimulating employment. Because the productivity of an entire economy is not the sum of the profits of the firms. The productivity of an entire economy is the output of the economy relative to the total population, especially the total adult population. And therefore, if you have unemployed people, that lowers productivity, because part of the society is not producing. And therefore, if you can get production going, useful production going, whatever form, infrastructure, whatever other form, that is useful. It improves productivity because more people are producing. And if it's done intelligently, it cannot help but benefit the economy as a whole. That was the way we used to think. We used to think about minimal amounts of unemployment. We used to think about improving the quality of employment. We used to think about raising the productivity in physical terms, in production, increasing skill levels, use skill levels, more investment in technology, less repetition, more innovation. These were the ways we tried to solve problems. From 1966 on, this changed. There was a change in values, which hit first at the youth, the university-age youth of the late second half of the 1960s. A shift against these values, a shift for so-called consumer values. The producer, the laborer, the worker, was considered the enemy of the proper culture. We had to go to a post-industrial culture, which meant a post-productive culture. We had to go to a post-agriculture culture, as well as a post, infrastructure culture. We had to lower our standard of living to have a simpler life based only on consumption. We had to eliminate blue collars and wear only white collars, that sort of thing. This change occurred and spread throughout the world and resulted in great social and moral and cultural convulsions over the period of the past 35 years. Now, today, people say we don't produce anymore. We import. We import cheap goods produced by cheap labor in other countries. How do we pay for it? On credit. We borrow the money, or we steal it from them. We ruin the currencies of countries that produce, and thereby we get what they produce cheaply. We lower their standard of living. We get things more cheaply. We buy on credit. We go into debt. But we don't worry, because we have the power. We can go into debt indefinitely. Now we have gone into debt so much that we are all bankrupt. And this happened over 35 years. Obviously, what we have to do is find some way to get back to sanity. We have to abandon the consumer value society and go to a producer value society, in which we produce the means on which we live, or the equivalent. We produce something useful for the world. We exchange our products with other parts of the world. We invest at home, we invest abroad in order to do this. We give credit in order to encourage people to buy our products, and that sort of thing. The way we used to solve problems, the way we solved the problems of the post-war period, the way in which Franklin Roosevelt led the United States out of a depression caused by the silliness of his predecessors, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Calvin Coolidge, and so forth. And the way we got through the war, the way Europe was rebuilt, reconstructed, in the period of the post-war period, up to the middle of the 1960s. That worked. Now, that system was included many things that were unfair to many people. The world was divided by a strategic conflict between the Soviet system and the Anglo-American and Allied systems. That was unjust. Justice was not given to the so-called developing sector. Roosevelt had promised the freedom of all nations from the colonial powers of Portugal, of Netherlands, of Belgium, of England, and of France. That wasn't done. Colonialism was reimposed at the point of a bayonet. And other forms of police were imposed. Africa was given freedom, but it was given no freedom. It was given the freedom to enslave itself, not true freedom to develop. Similarly in other parts of the world. So there were many injustices in this system, but the system worked. The system produced for those who benefited from it, the nations that benefited, it produces an improvement in the standard of living, in the progress of humanity. That began to come to an end 35 years ago. For 35 years ago, we have been increasingly insane. One of the benchmarks of insanity was Nixon's decision of August 1971. We destroyed a fixed exchange rate system on which progress had depended, international progress. We introduced a floating exchange rate system of insanity, which is the basis for the collapse of much of international trade and development. We stopped the regulation of economies, especially under Carter. We destroyed it. We changed the IMF into a monster. From being the instrument of nations, it became the monster that ate nations, including what it did to Italy beginning 1976 and that sort of thing. So now we've come to the point the system is bankrupt. It's hopelessly bankrupt. The system in its present form cannot be saved. It can only be saved by a bankruptcy reorganization. Since you cannot destroy a nation when you put it through bankruptcy, you must find means to save the nation from its own bankruptcy. You must save the true values. You must wipe out things that can't be paid. Wipe them off the books in order to get the economy moving again. You must create new credit, expand employment, inject new technologies, all the other things that have been done in the past to enable nations or the world to recover from depressions. This is not a normal depression. It's much worse than a depression. This is much worse than the depression that hit between 1929 and 1933 in most of the world, in Europe and in the Americas. It's far worse. This is what's called a general breakdown crisis. This does not mean that a depression sinks us into a deep slacking of our production, of mass unemployment. No. It means disorganization, destruction, obliteration of the institutions of government and nationhood. That's where we're at. The alternative is fairly clear. Now, Europe is now operating at a level of bankruptcy, Western Europe. That is, Western Europe is no longer producing enough to meet its current needs, to maintain its current levels of consumption and production. Typical is the case of Germany. Germany has become the keystone nation of Western Europe. All the other economies, the Benelux countries, Italy, France, and so forth, have depended for a number of years, especially since about 1976, have depended upon the role of Germany as an export-driven economy in order to stabilize Europe as a whole, through credits and other mechanisms, and also Germany as a market for other parts of Europe. Now that's come to an end. Germany has lost its position in export in every country except growth in China and in Russia, and a very large continued level of exports to India. Germany is collapsing. As you know, in Italy, the rest of the markets of Europe are collapsing too. The United States has ceased to be the importer of last resort. China must accept a 40% reduction in its expected exports. Other countries similarly, Southeast Asia, so forth. Japan is about to disintegrate. The fight between the former foreign minister Mrs. Tanaka, and Koizumi express an underlying tension, an explosion, waiting to blow up in Japan. Korea has been destroyed, largely by the United States in the aftermath of 1997, a looting operation, followed by an actual intentional wrecking crew. Korea is still a viable economy, South Korea. It could be brought back, but it's living on the edge of being crushed. As I say, China's in a crisis. Its external market of cheap goods to the United States and elsewhere has come to an end. It is now turning to its own internal market, investment in the deep interior, in the poorest sections of China, and in infrastructure generally, to try to maintain the Chinese economy at something like the present rate. India is in a crisis. Southeast Asia is being crushed by the effects of this collapse. So the question is, how does Europe get out of this? And the basic answer is exports. A revival of exports, but of a specific type. The principal market for European exports, West European exports, is Russia and Asia. It's a market which has three legs, Russia, China, and India. Not these nations alone, but these nations, if they cooperate, and if they cooperate in the intention of bringing Asia into a phase of general development, then European high technology and related exports become the means needed to assist Russia and the rest of Asia to begin to come up again at the rate needed. China needs technology. China has technology. It has some advanced industries. It has made much progress. But it has a large population, many of whom are extremely poor. And if we're going to meet the requirements of the interior of China and the people as a whole, more technology must be injected into China on the basis of medium to long-term credit than China could generate presently by its own means. India is a somewhat different economy, but it represents a similar kind of opportunity. It has high technology capabilities. It has reservoirs of well-trained, well-educated cadres. But it needs, again, infusions of additional technology from outside India in order to meet the requirements of all of its internal population, a growing population which will soon officially reach the level of 1 billion people. And India is only one of a group of nations, including Pakistan, Bangladesh, and others, which are in similar straits, or worse straits, Pakistan in particular. Iran is a land with complications, but it essentially is a very strong culture, a very ancient culture, or assimilation of many ancient cultures, blending of them, which has been the crossroads between the subcontinent, the Far East, and Europe for a long period of time. Remember things like the Arab Renaissance in the Caliph Harun al-Rashid and the Abbasid dynasty. We remember things of the great florescent period of Iran. We remember the transmission of advanced culture at the time the Roman Empire was disintegrating from India through Iran and through the Middle East into feudal Europe and so forth. So these are areas which all have a peculiar kind of potential. Differences in culture, different forms of potential, but they all have potential. And if they're able to cooperate, they represent a great and durable market for technology, supplies of various kinds, and technological assistance of other types from Europe into these markets. If the long-term credit can be mustered, that is credit at base rates of 1 to 2% simple interest over periods of up to 25 years for infrastructure and for other things, or for credit to banking systems or credit systems, for rollover credit in trade and so forth over a period of time, then we have a sustained long-term great market for the products of Europe, Western Europe, which are useful to the peoples in Russia, the peoples in Asia generally. And that is the way that Europe can recover, together with internal developments. We have to, of course, go back to an emphasis on technological progress, of the type of emphasis we had prior to 1966. We must go back to science-driven technological progress.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Now, there's another aspect of this in which the entrepreneur as such, as distinct from the corporate form of stock corporation, the absentee ownership. The problem with the absentee owner, the large corporation, the large industry, has been that the ownership residing in people who are interested in the profits from the stock, not the product of the country, company, are not progressive normally. Only with government stimulation do they become somewhat progressive. And the way you control that is generally by regulation. You set up rules and regulations of government, of finance, and taxation, and supervision, which in a sense fight against the reactionary tendencies of the stockholders to become simply bloodsuckers on the corporation and allow the corporation to concentrate itself on technological progress, improved qualities of product. In the case of the entrepreneur, it's different. The entrepreneur who is sitting in the firm he or she or his circles own as a closely held enterprise has a mission orientation. It's the way most entrepreneurships start. You know, you have cases in Italy where people started, their grandfather or their father or they themselves, started as workmen in some industry, as skilled workmen. They went out and often started a business in order to use something from their skill they thought they could market as a product or as a type of product or type of service, and succeeded. And they are people who are mission-driven to succeed and mission-driven to accomplish something useful in the community and for society in general. In other words, there's a personal sense of personal pride and identity in accomplishing a job done by building this firm and its activities. You will find in history, especially in modern history, that it is entrepreneurs of this type, particularly the science driver entrepreneurs, who tend to be the infusers of technological progress into the economy as a whole. For example, you take the case of space projects, which I've been involved in some degree. Now, you had a firm until what happened in the 1989-90 period, a firm, Messerschmitt-Bölk & Blohm in Germany. It was an aerospace firm which employed about 10,000 skilled cadres of machine tool grade. This firm was not merely important in itself for the space industry, aerospace industry, but it also, its progress, its technological progress, required it to call upon small industries of high technology throughout Germany. Often these smaller industries were owned by a scientist and a few engineers, or a group of engineers. They would develop a technology. A firm like an aerospace firm would go to these vendors and they would procure from them an improvement in technology necessary for the new product they were designing. This firm, like this aerospace firm, would go to larger firms which built aircraft or built other things, spacecraft, and they would contribute their component into the total effort of such the spacecraft or whatever. So that's the way industry tended to function. In the United States, it was not the large automobile industries that made the successes in the automobile industry. It was the smaller firms, their vendors, who developed the products which as components or elements were included in the design of the vehicle and made it work. So it was the entrepreneur, the person who broke his back, in a sense, in order to achieve something more than profit, and expected to make a living and expected to have his company grow as a result of those efforts. The same thing is true today. Now, there's a very specific problem here. The problem is a moral one. What is a moral way of generating a profit? Moral way of generating profit. Well, first of all, what's moral? What is morality? Some people have lists they paste on the wall. Don't do this, do this. Mothers do that sometimes with children. Employers do that sometimes with employees. Do this, don't spit here, don't do that, you know, so forth. Well, that is not morality. That is an attempt to manage. And business management is a very bad thing. It is not morality, it is not good economics. Morality is an understanding, this is especially clear in Christianity, or should be clear to those who profess to be Christians, is an understanding of a fundamental difference between any animal species and humanity, and the human individual. Only the human individual has those powers of discovery of universal principles by which man is able to increase our species' power to exist in the universe. No other species but man is capable of increasing its so-called ecological potential. Only mankind can do it. Mankind does this through creativity. By creativity, we often mean, typified by Leonardo da Vinci or Johannes Kepler or others, we often refer to physical scientific discoveries of universal principle, like Kepler's discovery of a principle of universal gravitation, first reported in 1609 in a book called The New Astronomy, where the process of discovery is detailed in great length. to be studied again today for people who want to learn how to make discoveries. But also there are other areas of discovery which are important. When you discover a principle, a true universal principle, and you test it, how do you communicate that discovery to somebody else? You have to share with them the reliving of the process of discovery. They have to relive the experience of the problem, the paradox, which could not be explained without the discovery. They have to relive the effort to find the solution to that paradox. They have to relive the experience of the kind of experimental test which demonstrates whether or not that proposed solution is true or not. Therefore, it is social relations among people of this form, in communication of discovery of created ideas, which is the basis for the ability of society to apply discoveries of fundamental principle to nature. In other words, society is not improved by one person making a discovery and running out and screaming Eureka in the streets, like thinking he's Archimedes. No. Discoveries are made by individuals, and only the individual human mind can make a discovery. But how do you get members of a society to cooperate in developing and using a discovery? They must share the experience of making that discovery, reenacted. For example, if you had a good science education, you didn't learn from a textbook. You never learned from a textbook. A textbook was a nuisance. It distracted you. You learn by reliving the original act of discovery by a specific discoverer. You are presented the problem, you relive the agony of trying to deal with a paradox. You thought you saw the solution to the paradox. And then with the aid of a classroom teacher or someone else, you came to recognize whether this discovery you thought you'd made was true or not. Then you both had the experience. Now you could share that experience and cooperate. That was a good scientific education, where you shared the experience of discoveries made by people from many thousands and hundreds of years before. This is called a classical education as opposed to a textbook education, as opposed to a drill and grill education of the type that people tend to get today. So therefore, the social relations among people, as typified by that quality of education, that approach to education, is the basis for people's ability to cooperate and apply discoveries to increase the human race's power in nature and over nature. That's the difference between man and animal. Therefore, man, since we recognize by that standard that man is not an animal, that man has a creative power which we otherwise can attribute only to the creator of the universe. Therefore, every person has a sacred quality because of this natural endowment of every person. Morality is regard for what that implies. Morality is what Plato and what Paul and the Apostle John also referred to as agape, which is sometimes called in English, is called the general welfare, or is called in theology sometimes the common good. This principle of agape, typified, for example, in Christianity by 1 Corinthians 13, is the essence of morality. It is not do's and don'ts, as the Apostle Paul emphasizes in that source. It is true love of mankind. Love of mankind in the sense that man, as each individual, embodies the image of the creator of the universe. And therefore, our relations to other people must be creative relations, relations based on this creativity. We must organize our activities not to repeat what we already know, but to create new solutions and to share those solutions and their benefits. It is the process of progress, not any fixed result, which is precious. Now, the true entrepreneur or the entrepreneur who has discovered this about themselves and their own role in life, has a special morality. We're all going to die. And so therefore what we accomplish within our life as such does not mean much. We die. We don't take that with us. But what do we leave after us? What is never taken away from us is we have contributed to the process of the progress of humanity. We have done something good today. We have done something good this year. We have made things better, and we have created a foundation, a platform on which humanity can build further. We become a part of an eternity which, in a sense, exists in simultaneity. We are part of humanity from all past history and all future history. And it's that sense of personal identity that enables the true entrepreneur, particularly as the great inventor, who sometimes spends generations in trying to develop a time, 25, 50 years. I know individuals who've done that, who spent 25 to 50 years of their life trying to solve, bring a problem to a solution. And therefore, what's the motivation of somebody who does that? Next year's profit? No. It's being able to keep the business alive, keep it going, to get to the next step, to get to the next program, the next product, the next challenge. Now, what awaits you out there? Many of you are involved in this, in export areas. Not only within Europe, but outside Europe, outside the European community. Particularly when you go into countries like Russia, for example. You face very special kinds of problems, which are not the problems that you're familiar with in Europe. How does the entrepreneur succeed? Some of you work at this, I'm sure. I don't know individually, but I'm sure some of you do this. You find yourself, for example, in Russia. In Russia, there is no understanding of entrepreneurship. That was the problem of the Soviet system. The Soviet system undervalued the individual, undervalued the individual morally. The tendency in Russia was to do the same thing over and over and over again. You could not introduce changes. Where did Russia make changes? In the military, scientific field. Why? Because they didn't think it was economics. They thought it was patriotism. They thought it was warfare. They thought it was desperation to save the nation, to make it powerful. It was a mission orientation. A mission for scientific progress. And they did it. They performed miracles in that area. But the same Russians in a Russian industry, a civilian industry, were failures. Now you go into Eastern Europe, in the former Soviet Union, or in Poland, or other parts of the Comecon, you will find the same problem. They don't know what entrepreneurship is. And therefore, you will find great opportunities for partnerships and similar kinds of relations with people in Russia or in other countries, but they don't know what entrepreneurship is. So sometimes the most important thing you take with you to them is the fact that you know how to think as an entrepreneur and they don't. And you'll be able to show them and introduce to them the way of thinking as an entrepreneur. So what we have to do, essentially, in reaching out around the world, is we have to have a mission orientation as opposed to a corporate profit orientation. Yes, we're not going to make losses if we can avoid them. We're going to make profits because it's necessary to make profits to keep the enterprise going and progressing. But we're not in there for profit. We make profit as a means to an end. Profit is a means to keep going, to keep doing our job. Like a person who does his job for hire. He does his job and tries to progress on the job by improving his technology, improving himself. The entrepreneur does the same thing with an added feature. Improve himself, improve the enterprise. Be able to take on new challenges, solve new kinds of problems. And it's a set of achievement that the dying entrepreneur can say, I have achieved something I give to you to continue. Progress. Do something good for humanity. And that's what's required. Therefore, we must organize society with that in view. We have out there in Eurasia, and Eurasia is the immediate market for Europe, Western Europe. Yes, there's Africa, but that's another problem. We have to do things about that too. The Americas, that's a different problem. But Eurasia is the immediate market for Europe, Western Europe. So, what's our problem? What do we have to do? Well, first of all, we have to build a system which realizes what the potential of Asia is, Eurasia is. Now let's look at the central part of Asia. Central Asia as such and the northern part of Asia. It's a desert to semi-desert area. In the north, it's a tundra, which is frozen much of the year, with a permafrost underneath, which never really fully melts. But in this area, which is otherwise somewhat desolate, there's some of the concentration of mineral deposits, the most precious on the planet. To get at these things, you have to build an infrastructural corridor development to get in there. You have to apply the technology which enables you to master these areas. You have to move great rivers like the Lena and Ob and transfer some of the waters downward into Central Asia rather than just let them flow into the Arctic and waste it. You have to build the infrastructure which enables you to build urban centers in the tundra area which are acceptable for human life and work. That's another challenge. You have to do the same thing in the desert area. You have to do mass projects of water development. You have to also build, make a transformation in the character of the Eurasian continent. Until a recent time, in all human existence, the major means of economic development was by water. Now this is still true for Italy in terms of the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean was the basis for the culture, development of the culture of Europe. The development of Egypt, intersecting with the invasions chiefly from the peoples of the sea, such as the Etruscans and such as the Ionian Greeks and so forth, developed a Mediterranean culture from which emerged classical Greek culture and Hellenistic culture, which is the basis for European culture in general. And that still is the basis, geographically and strategically, and especially for Italy, which is sitting in the middle of the Mediterranean, poking itself down there, poking toward Tunisia, a short distance beyond Sicily, poking toward Egypt, which is the bridge to Asia, poking toward Egypt, which is one of the chief bridges into Africa, where the next great shield of mineral potential shield is located in the South African Shield. Great sources of minerals of the future. In a poor area which needs development, we have to, as missionaries in a sense, bring economic development into that region. So what's this challenge in Asia? Well, I should point out to you a gentleman of some interest to me. His name is Vladimir Vinadsky. He was a great Russian scientist who was of the school of Mendeleev, who studied like Mendeleev in Germany and in France, who worked with the Pasteur successors, Curie, who went back to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution and became really the most effective leading scientist of Russia, who developed the concept of the biosphere, who went beyond that, who was the father of modern nuclear technology. He was in Russia in 1925, was committed under Vinadsky to develop nuclear energy as a source of power for humanity. He understood it. He was the father of all Russian nuclear technology. It was Vinadsky. Now, we're out there looking at this area of the world. We have vast mineral deposits. We have what is called an ecology, a biosphere out there, which needs to be transformed. We have human beings who can transform that. But we have to do it right. We cannot simply go out helter-skelter and try to transform the biosphere or transform this planet without knowing what we're doing. Therefore, we have to take a science like that of Vinadsky, the science of the biosphere and noosphere. We have to treat that as an applied science in the development of the concepts of how to do the greatest engineering job that's ever been done on this planet, the transformation of this vast area of Eurasia, including Central and North Asia, from a permanent, semi-permanent desert into one of the rich lodes on which the future development of Western Europe, other parts of Asia, including China, India, and so forth, depend absolutely. So we have a mission orientation out there, a chance to change the face of humanity, to give a new challenge, a new moral challenge to humanity, to progress, to take the practical problem before us of bringing this economy of Western Europe in particular out of depression, out of chaos, into something great, something of which your descendants will be proud, and you should be proud in doing. We have out there among that a great specific challenge, an immediate challenge of how do we transform Central Asia and North Asia from an essentially non-usable area predominantly, of desert, of wasteland, of tundra, how do we transform that into the potential it represents for all of Eurasia? And how do we go beyond that into Africa and take a similar problem but different in Southern Africa? How do we transform that area into something for its own people and something for all humanity at the same time? We have a similar situation in the Americas. South America is rich. Argentina has a rich potential which somebody's trying to steal for nothing presently. Patagonia, tremendous potential. Italians, we used to want to flood over there and conquer the place because of the rich potential there. Brazil has tremendous potential. So similarly, we have great biosphere, great noosphere challenges in various parts of the world. This is not the end, but this is an intermediate term for the next 50 years, the next 75 years. These are the great challenges for which we should prepare ourselves and future generations. In the meantime, in getting in that direction, with that understanding, we must transform the individual's conception of humanity. The most important thing of all, we must understand what morality is. We must understand the true significance for practice of the fact that we can demonstrate in the laboratory that man is made in the image of the creator of this universe as no other creature is. And therefore, human purposes, human missions, human social relations must be based on that conception of man. We must understand in particular the role of true entrepreneurship as the vehicle which mediates the power of creativity as generated in our culture and translates that into practical applications as solutions for practical problems which arise in the course of business. If we take that view, if we eliminate the nonsense which pollutes us, if we get away from being a consumer society to becoming a society oriented to producing good, in the sense, moral sense of good, produce good for humanity by solving particular problems for particular human beings or groups of human beings. Do good and achieve and survive in doing it. That is what we need. No matter what the program is, without that kind of change, we will not succeed. We thought we had succeeded in rebuilding after the war, in the 20 years from 1945 to the middle of the 1960s. But look what happened. We had solved many problems. We had succeeded. We had an economy that worked. What did we do? We destroyed it in a shift from producer value to consumer values. We destroyed it by denying creativity. We destroyed it by destroying our educational systems. We don't educate children in schools anymore. We blab at them. We tell them to look it up on the internet. We don't tell them, we don't allow them to think anymore. We don't encourage it. We destroyed the culture upon which, from the Renaissance period on, all European achievement was based. So the danger is not that we don't know how to succeed. Humanity has succeeded before. The danger is that we will throw it away again the way we threw it away during the past 35 years. And therefore, I would say that apart from all the technical matters which fascinate me and which are motivate me greatly, that this technical concern will fail unless we can situate that in terms of reference to a moral sense of why do we do what we do? Why do we choose this system? Why do we not abandon it? Because we keep our eyes on the moral principle that the human being is made in the image of the creator of the universe, and we have to deal with each other and with the universe accordingly. Thank you.
That was Lyndon LaRouche, March 22nd in Milan, Italy. Before signing off for this week's edition of the LaRouche Connection, let me remind you that on Wednesday, May 1st, at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Lyndon LaRouche will be addressing an international webcast, which you can access on LaRouche's campaign website, www.larouche2004.org. I hope all of you will join us for that historic event. This has been Jeff Steinberg for the LaRouche Connection.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.